You are in the room. You can see on the wall a brewery for all. So I just want to make sure you know where you're in the right place. Please make sure before we get started, check your cell phones, turn the ringers off if you can. And make sure at the end of this session, if you go into the CBC app, you can actually rate the session. So we're always looking for feedback, so please do that. So my name is Julie Verratti. I am the chair of the diversity committee at the Brewers Association and a member of the board of directors. And I co-own Denizens Brewing Company in Silver Spring, Maryland. And I have the distinct pleasure of introducing our speaker today. But before I do that, I know that there are members of the diversity committee in the room, and so I'm going to ask you guys, please stand up so everyone can identify you if you're on the committee. Thank you. You know, our committee is a year old, and we still have a lot of work ahead of us, so we welcome your ideas, your thoughts. Please engage with us. Come talk to us. Is it working? Okay. Okay. You sure? Okay. All right. So for many of you who are here, you're probably aware, Dr. J. Nicole Beckham is the very first diversity ambassador to work for the Brewers Association. We are very excited to have her. She's a professor at Randolph College. She's a PhD. And more importantly, she's a longtime homebrewer and beer aficionado and an absolute expert when it comes to diversity and inclusion. I have been looking forward to this talk since we found out she was going to be here speaking, and I hope you guys are too. So please, everybody, give a round of applause to Dr. J. Okay.
So I'm going to see, lapel mic is good, volume is good?
Yep.
Awesome, awesome. All right, well, as you just heard, my name is Dr. J. Nicole Jackson Beckham. I commonly go by Jay, though lots of folks here have taken to calling me Dr. J, which I like quite a lot. So I was going to start today with a kind of clunky introduction, and I was going to talk about, you know, my craft beer moment, and then some of the things I've been doing over the last 15 years that prepared me to be the first diversity ambassador for the Brewers Association. But I'm not going to do that. I decided instead I'm going to start actually with a story about something that happened to me yesterday. So I decided to head over to East Nashville. It's a neighborhood just over the river. There was another kind of CBC-related event going on over there, and I decided to head over in the evening, and I needed a ride. So I'm staying at the Omni across the street, and I went down to the concierge desk, and I said, hey, you know, what's Nashville's cab scene like, right? Like, can I, like, throw up my hand and hail a cab and one will come, or do I have to call somebody? And they were like, well, your best bet is really actually like Uber or Lyft. And I was like, well, I doggedly am committed to the idea that Uber is just like hitchhiking with an app, so I'm not going to do that. So what can I do? And he was like, well, where are you going? And I told him, and he said, well, that's within 3 miles, and the hotel has a car, and we can just drive you over there and drive you back, and no problem. And I was like, that's awesome, right? So 5 minutes later, I'm in the back seat of a really nice Lincoln SUV, chatting with a driver named Bruce. And it was, you know, about 4-ish, 4:30, so we're pushing on rush hour, and there's a little bit of traffic. And we had some real time to talk. And, you know, he's a professional in the hospitality industry, and inevitably, right, the question comes up, what brings you to Nashville? Well, you know, I've had this thing around my neck for a couple days now, and I kind of did this so he could see it in the rearview mirror, and I said, yeah, I'm here with the conference across the street. And he was like, with all the beer people? You must be one of a kind. And I was like, what do you mean? Right? And he backpedaled a little bit, but he was like, well, I mean, okay, well, what do you do for the beer people? Are you, like, a consultant or something? You know, and so I was thinking about that, and I'm, you know, we're chatting, and it's friendly, and I look in the rearview mirror and, you know, see this really kind, curious face, and honestly, he has eyes just like my dad. And looking at him, I just wanted to lie. I wanted to lie straight to his face and say, yeah, I'm a brewer. Right? Because at a conference of 14,000 people, with over 2,400 breweries sending reps here, it was inconceivable to him that I worked in or for a brewery. Right? And this speaks to something larger that's stuck with me since I first came to craft beer in the early 2000s. It stuck with me a couple years later when I started homebrewing. It stuck with me after I passed that damn BJCP test and became a provisional judge and started stewarding. It stuck with me when I started managing a homebrew store that had 5 locations throughout North Carolina and Virginia. It stuck with me when I started the research project about the American brewing industry that would eventually become my doctoral dissertation and my first book forthcoming. And it sticks with me now as I'm invited to speak around the country at academic events and general interest events and historical societies. Right? The big thrust is, since I came to craft beer, I have looked at everyone and said, yeah, these are my people. You are my people. I love geeking out with you about beer. I love drinking beer with you. I have always felt a deep and comfortable connection to this community. But in spite of that, I have also said, if you are my people, why don't more of you look like me? Now, this seminar today is, of course, not about my own internal tension. I can work my own stuff out on my own time. But it does, it's emblematic of a broader challenge that the industry faces now. And I want to start by saying that I think it's a challenge that everybody in here has more than enough talent and creativity and dedication to achieve. Because if you can start a brewery, right, we can get that beer to more people and more situations to enjoy it. So the first thing I want to start with is mastering this clicker. And then after that, right, the kind of the main thrust of this, right? Everybody in here, we all want to diversify craft beer. And there's a lot of advantages to doing so. Yesterday, we talked a lot about numbers, right, in the general session. And one of the things you probably heard over and over again is that white, male, Gen X, and millennial drinkers are the majority of the folks who are drinking the products that you brew. You also heard that there are more and more people entering this market with at least a not as rapidly growing share, right, of customers to buy the product, and that there will be some competition for a share of the pie. It makes sense, then, that some of the best opportunities for growth are simply exploring underexplored demographics. Right? If you are going to grow, you cannot simply sell beer to young white dudes with beards. Right? If you had the privilege of watching Cody Keenan's talk yesterday, you also heard him speak for a moment about making intentional effort to diversify the speechwriting team that he brought to the Obama administration. And he talked about how that was not an act of tokenism, but it was absolutely necessary to diversifying the perspectives of the people that were doing the work for this particular administration. That it was necessary to reach their constituencies in an authentic and meaningful way. I believe the same is true for your breweries. Without exploring diverse populations, you leave some opportunities on the table for new perspectives, right? New opinions, new techniques, new flavors. And third, I think there's an issue of ethics here, right? Lots of you, because you're in this room, I can gather that you at least have some personal ethics about diversity inclusion. And I don't mean politics, I mean ethics. You believe that your brewery doors should be open to everybody who wants to come in. And I know for a fact that many people feel both extreme frustration and sadness when they believe that everybody can come and then they look at their establishment and they don't see everybody. That's a profoundly frustrating situation. So the question is, if we all really want to diversify craft beer, why is it so hard to do it? And interestingly, the question is the answer, right? Because it's hard. It's really hard. As a college professor, I have students come in to me, generally the first week of school, right? Like the ass kissers come in. And they're like, I really want to get an A in this class. And I'm like, yeah. Right? Yeah. And then like 3 weeks later when they're not doing anything and they haven't turned into science and they're like, I really want to get an A in this class. And I'm like, yeah. Right? And then like close to the end of the semester, you know, now they're like really kind of falling off and they're like, I really want to get an A in this class. And I'm like, I know you want to get an A in the class, but do you want to do the work that it requires to earn an A in this class? Because those are two different things. And so today what I want to do is give you a little bit of framework, a little bit of scaffolding for figuring out how to do the hard work of diversifying your businesses. And because I'm a college professor, I'm going to lay it all out, right? I'm going to tell you how it's going to work. So we've got three things that we're going to try to accomplish in this seminar today. So first, again, I'm a college professor of communication and cultural studies. I love lists and metaphors and things that come in threes. So what we're going to do is three opportunities, three metaphors, three problems, three solutions. All right? Three opportunities, three problems, three metaphors, three solutions. Second, this is going to be an interactive seminar. I won't be able to talk at you for an hour, so I actually want you to talk back. In fact, I'm going to give you some assignments. So those of you who have paper, get ready, right? I'm going to ask you to write some things down, or if you have like the right, you can do that too. If you have a question, I want you to ask in the middle. I don't want you to wait to the end. And I'm going to be calling on some folks for some feedback, all right? So if you're like the not shy one, right, I'll be relying on you to give me some feedback. Number three, every good lecture or class or syllabus has some learning objectives. So I have some learning objectives associated with this today. And really, I only have one. I want to make sure that by the end of this talk, you have some ideas for some things that you can put into action the day you step back into your breweries. All right. So let's get started. All right. Three opportunities. So a lot of times when people talk about diversity and inclusion, they talk about problems, right? Like, what's the problem? Where's the problem come from? How do we solve the problem? And I actually kind of hate that. I don't want to talk about diversity and inclusion in terms of problems. Rather, I want to talk about it in terms of opportunities. And as I see it, you have three major areas of opportunity you can work on. Right? Your fans, those are your guests, your consumers, your hands, right? Those are the folks who work for you, your employees and staff, and your brand. Right? Your packaging, your marketing, how you put yourself out there. What I'd like to do today is make sure that everything we talk about in this kind of three-tiered system, right? Fans, hands, brand. In fact, I'm giving you your first assignment right now. I want each of you to take a minute and think about opportunities, right? The opportunities you have in your own places of business to expand diversity and inclusion efforts. And what I want you to do is give yourself an opportunity score, right? So we'll go 1 to 10, 1 being not much opportunity here, 10 being worlds of opportunity here. Give yourself a score for your fans, your hands, and your brand, right? How much opportunity do you have to affect change in terms of diversity and inclusion in your business? All right. All right, keep your score, right, either in your head or write it down, and we'll revisit it later. All right, so problem number one, right, the problem of means and ends. All right, so let's start with a metaphor. So has anyone in this room right now spent any serious time training in a martial arts discipline? Yeah? Okay, has anybody gone far enough to earn a black belt? No? Brown? Brown, purple, brown right here. All right, what do you practice? Wing Chun, can you tell me a little bit about it? Oh, yeah, that's awesome. Okay, can you do me a favor and just, like, stand up? You mind? No? Okay, awesome. What's your name?
Andrew.
Okay, awesome. So one of you who did not raise your hand, never studied any sort of martial art, can you please, somebody else, just give me a volunteer and stand up as well? Anybody? There we go. All right, let's get this guy right here. Can you tell me your name?
I'm Merritt.
Merritt?
Yes.
Awesome. Nice to meet you, Merritt. Okay. So, Merritt, I need you to do me a favor. All right. Is there any martial art you would like to practice if you ever did? TV Taekwondo, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Let's just call it Taekwondo because I have no idea. All right. I need you to do me a favor, okay? All right. I want you to repeat after me. Say, I have a black belt in Taekwondo.
I have a black belt in Taekwondo.
Awesome. Okay. So what I'd like to do is actually get you two guys together and maybe have, like, a little fight. We can... No? Okay. All right, all right, yeah. All right. Before we get started... Yeah. Does anybody want to place any wagers on who's going to take this fight? Anybody? No? Success? What? Not getting your ass kicked? Right? Maybe? Okay. I'm going to imagine that we love you, Merritt, but probably we're not going to back you too hard. That's all right. I mean, that's cool.
Either.
Yeah? All right. Thank you, guys. You can take a seat. All right. The point I want to make here is that even though Merritt stood up like a really game participant and declared his black belt in Taekwondo, it did absolutely nothing to change the reality of his skill level or the likelihood that he would win a fight with somebody who was actually training. This is the same in diversity and inclusion initiatives. Declaring that you care about diversity is not achieving anything. Right? Unfortunately, this is often what we do when it comes to diversity and inclusion initiatives. We mix up the ends and the means. Diversity is an end, but it is not the means to that end. And declaring that you value diversity is not a process for arriving at that end. Just as earning a black belt is a process or a sustained effort in cultivating individual habits of mind and body, achieving diversity requires sustained efforts in cultivating organizational habits of attitude and action. So organizational attitudes of habits and, or excuse me, habits of attitude and action. Let me kind of explain what I mean there. Right. And I'll get a little bit sciencey for a second because I'm a social scientist. It's just what I do. So habits of mind, right? The first half of that. Habits of mind are critical in countering the effects of unconscious bias. And I know lots of you probably heard this term. It's in the news a lot. You probably heard it today earlier. But I want to explain a little bit about how unconscious bias works. Right? So let's just do a little free association. You can just yell at me. I'm going to give you a term. You just tell me first thing comes to your head. Right? French fries.
Ketchup.
Right. Yeah. Fries. French fries. Yeah. Sorry. She's like, French people. Right. Christmas. Okay. Right? So, like, very quickly, we got a couple of different things, but largely, you all kind of said same things, right? I got a lot of ketchups. I got a lot of presents. I got a lot of trees. Right? But when I said French fries, nobody was like, motor oil, right? And that's because learning, right, holding attitudes is a process of association. So I'm going to do some very rudimentary and ugly neurology right now. Don't spread this. Right, but what is essentially happening when you have an attitude or when you learn something is that your brain is simply making associations, right? Somewhere in your brain that holds the concept of French fries, right? And somewhere in your brain that holds the concept of ketchup are like following a neurological pathway and firing and making an association. Make sense? What's interesting about this is that it kind of works like muscles. The more you make an association, the faster it gets in your brain, and the easier your brain has a time making it, and the more difficult your brain has a time making other associations. All right? So when you really hotwire one particular group of associations, right, we scientifically call that a bias, right, because your brain is more likely to make that association than any other. So people who are doing unconscious bias research are actually timing your associations. Right? So they're saying, if I give you this idea, and I give you this idea, if they happen really quickly, right, then you essentially have a bias there. If they happen a little more slowly, you don't have a bias. Right? Make sense? Okay. What's interesting now is that if you want to disrupt one of these associations, you have to actively counter it. Right. You can't just leave it alone, because leaving it alone actually confirms it. So, for example, I watched a lot of Law & Order, Original Flavor, the other ones are like, whatever, but right, Original Flavor, Law & Order is like my business. Like, I was like, now the police work, now the law, right? And it's awesome. But if you watch Law & Order in the first decade, and then you watch the second decade, what you realize is like they worked really hard to reframe their storytelling in that second decade. Because in the first decade, of like if you were brown or of some other like non-heterosexual thing, you were either like dead or killing someone. That's it. Right. And so if you're a person who's like constantly making a certain association, let's say you say brown, criminal, right? And it's in there, every time you watch Law & Order, that association is reconfirmed. Right? It's reconfirmed in your head. And every time you make the association and something doesn't actively disrupt it, right, it's strengthened. So this suggests that just leaving things alone actually isn't enough. You need to cultivate habits of attitude that disrupt any associations that might serve as a barrier to achieving what you want as far as diversity is concerned. Excuse me. This also gives us an opportunity to reframe diversity in another way, right? Because I think a lot of times when we talk about diversity and inclusion, we talk about intention. But what we know about unconscious bias tells us that intention lots of times doesn't have much to do with it. That lots of times what's happening is unintentional, and that we have to make a sustained effort to root it out and address it. That also means that blame really isn't going to help in fixing the problems or addressing the challenges that we have with diversity and inclusion. Second, we want to talk about habits of body or habits of action. Habits of action or habits of body are important because they help us define what's normal. Right? And I happen to think that people leave a tremendous opportunity unrealized when they don't intentionally work to establish norms of behavior in the spaces they work and the spaces they go socially. So I'll give you an example. I was living in Durham, North Carolina for about 5 years. I loved Durham. And I used to hang out at Full Steam Brewery. No one from Full Steam's in the room? Yeah. So Full Steam, like lots of breweries around the country, their tap room is almost like a community center, right? And every time people would come visit me, I'd be like, oh yeah, we're going to Full Steam. So a friend of mine came in, she had her kids, a baby and a toddler, and was like, what do you want to do? And I was like, oh, get on to Full Steam and have some beers. And she was like, what? I was like, yeah, yeah, it's okay. And she's like, are you sure? And I was like, I'm sure there's babies there all the time. She's like, oh, okay, babies there all the time. Right? And the point is, right, that once there's an established norm for behavior, for what's okay, it's really easy for people to keep going with it. As human beings, we are remarkably adaptable and very, very good at picking up on environmental and behavioral cues. So if you intentionally set the standards, the norms, in the spaces that you have an opportunity to do so, right, you can change behavior rather quickly. So solution, right? How do you start working on cultivating these habits of attitude and action? Well, first you want to define your diversity. And three things to think about here. You need to give it context and specificity. It's becoming one of my mantras, but I will say it again here. There is no one-size-fits-all diversity. It needs to be specific and contextually rooted in your region, in your brewery, and in your organizational goals. So that's my second part, my point here. Connect it to your organizational goals. Right? What are you trying to accomplish broadly with your organization? Are you trying to grow? Right? Are you trying to hit sustainable operation? Are you trying to become a leader in your community? Right? What are your organizational goals? And connect it up to what you are already doing. And third, consider a responsibility structure. A responsibility structure is simply a person or people who are given the responsibility for both planning and assessing diversity initiatives. And there was a recent study conducted by scholars at Harvard, Berkeley, and University of Minnesota. They were doing a survey of organizations who were actively trying to diversify their workforces. And they were kind of essentially saying, what do you do, and how is it working for you? And they found that there were kind of four categories of things that people generally try to do when they're working to diversify their organizations. Diversity training, right, which is oftentimes the kind of training meeting, webinar, HR thing. Mentoring and networking is the second one. Responsibility structures are the third. And the fourth is advocacy of diversity. So picking a cause or picking an issue and getting behind it. Research says that the most effective initiative was having a responsibility structure, right? Designating somebody who's in charge of planning and keeping up whether or not it's working. Any guesses to what's the least effective? Right, I'll say the remaining options. Diversity training. Anybody want to raise their hand? Vote. Okay, yeah. Mentoring, networking. Yeah. Advocacy of diversity issues. Okay. Most of you raised your hand on the first. You are totally right. Right. I can't tell you how many diversity training things I've sat through, and at the end I'm like melted, and I'm like, ugh. And then I realized, I'm like, oh, that was supposed to benefit me. Right? But it was painful and awful. So keep that in mind. So your second assignment, right? What I want you to do is think about some diversity outcomes. Yeah?
I have a question about that.
Yeah, sorry, we have a question. Do you want, I'm going to do this.
I can check. You guys hear me?
Oh,
hello?
Yeah.
So for to emphasize that point, is that across the board? So if you have someone who's starting from zero, like has no concept diversity or even thinking about diversity training, and they get the training, does that help them more than people who are already proactively thinking about it?
So at least from an aggregate perspective, the research says no. Okay. And the research actually says that it makes it worse. Right? Because essentially what happens is usually that's the only thing that happens, right? The training. They're like, we went to the training, now you're diverse, right? And then what happens is the culture is like, yes, we went through the training. We have good diversity here. And then when something actually happens, people are like, no, you're full of because we went through the training. Right? So it actually causes people to like ignore actual issues when they happen. And people are not prepared to handle it. Yeah, thank you for the question. Okay, so second assignment, right? What I want you to do is think about some diversity outcomes, right? The question to guide you here is, what will things look like, sound like, feel like, be like when you achieve your definition of diversity, right? Now, I want you to think about outcomes that are measurable, but I do not want you to think about quota, right? We're not thinking checkbox diversity. Right. So what does it mean when you have achieved it? And I'll think about some examples here. Excuse me. So let's say you're looking, your opportunities are with your fans. Right? You might say something like, our sales will increase by X percent or X dollars as a result of engaging with underexplored markets brokered through a new series of events and partnerships. Let's say you're looking at your hands, right? You might say something like, our taproom staff will better reflect the surrounding community, connecting us to new customers and collaborators. Or let's say you're looking at your brand. You might say, decisions about all of our packaging will include a serious consideration of social impact. Right? These are all measurable and achievable objectives. Right? So I'm gonna throw this at you. I want you to like talk to your neighbors, right? Make some objectives that might work, think about your opportunities, and then I want a little bit of sharing. Somebody come up with one that they were willing to share. All right, go. Yeah, cool. So she said she lives in an area of Minneapolis where they're embedded in a community where lots of different neighborhoods are spoken, and they'd love for people to be able to walk into their tap room and maybe hear other languages being spoken there. Yeah, right, that's great. Any others? Yeah, back here. That would be awesome.
Hey, everybody. My name is Kaylee Parton. I'm the director of marketing and events at Rising Tide in Portland, Maine. And I came from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, which is substantially more diverse than Maine. And it was one of the things when I first started, we had events with this local organization that was trying to create spaces and networking opportunities for a more diverse population so that we all, like, no, we're all there in Maine. And it was super awesome, and we had them on, like, on a monthly basis. And then they did, like, smaller roundtable discussion events, and we just kind of reserve a part of our tasting room for them to, like, come in and talk about things. And unfortunately, like, that something happened on that group, and they haven't been back in a while, and I don't know, like, whether they just dissolved or what. So I'm hoping to reach out to that person and be like, hey, what's going on, and how can we bring you back in and have this space? Because we now run an events program, and I've had multiple hosts be like, oh, I was at that event, and it was just so cool because I felt safe. And so, like, then that got me thinking that I identify as a part of the LGBT community, and, like, Portland's actually a pretty gay town, but we tend to be homebodies, and, like, all the gay bars have shut down because of the internet. And so I was thinking, like, it might be super cool to kind of take that same thing and implement that and have that events in our space for another community of people and to continue to create that welcoming environment. But that's just kind of in my back pocket.
Yeah, great. Idea. Thank you. Right, so forging connections, right? Like community events. Really simple, right? Measurable objectives. Awesome. Well, I want to move on to our second problem and our second metaphor now. And our second problem is the issue of barriers and bait. So here's the metaphor, right? This is an ant, in case you can't tell. So I live in a 100-year-old house in Central Virginia. It's a big federal, and it has, like, I don't know, 20-foot ceilings or something insane. It lets all the heat out, so I don't objectively measure it. But, you know, in the summer, when it warms up, we get ants, right? There's no way to keep them out of a house that old. And they frustrate me, but I also spend a lot of time watching ants. And if you're anything like me, like, as soon as you look at something, you're like, oh, I'm going to see if there's a nature documentary about this. And so I watched one about ants. And ants are actually really fascinating creatures. They have this really complex social structure, and it's generally completely negotiated through a system of chemical pheromone signaling. So, like, certain ants will, like, give off a certain chemical pheromone, like, I'm a worker ant, I'm going to get food, or, like, this is the trail to the food, follow me, right? Some of them are like, there's danger here, everybody run, right? And it's all the system of pheromones. And what's fascinating, if you watch ants for long enough, you can kind of see it happening, right? Like, you'll see an ant, like, running, and then it'll just, like, stop and be like, ugh, right? And if you watch ants, you're just kind of like, what is that crazy little thing doing, right? And it's because we don't see their pheromone trails. We don't have the necessary equipment to perceive it. And so this is what I want to take from this metaphor, right? Just because you don't perceive a barrier doesn't mean it's not there. And for lots of people who want to patronize certain places or buy certain products, they may be perceiving and running into a barrier that you just don't see. And just because you don't have the equipment to perceive it does not mean it's not real. Even even if you don't have the equipment to perceive it, you should at least consider that it's real for someone else, and that because of that, you might want to try to address it. Unfortunately, what happens when we think about getting people into our breweries or getting people into spaces is we often think of trying to lure them in, right? Bait. And the thing is, again, something else Cody said yesterday, like people have pretty sophisticated bullshit detectors, right? Like can tell when you're just trying to lure them in. And a lot of people don't want to be lured, right? In fact, people have really serious problems with you making choices or assumptions on their behalf. So your best bet is to try to identify perceived barriers to access and then remove them. So I know you all in 2015 heard a presentation at CBC that was about some of this kind of issue, and what I want to do is break down what we mean by perceived barriers a little bit more closely. And so I want to talk about four different kinds of barriers. So first, resource barriers. Do your folks or the people who might visit your brewery, the people who might work in your brewery, or the people who might look at your brand and engage with it, have the resources they need to have an authentic engagement with your business? Resources are not, we think money immediately, right? But I'm not just talking about cost. In fact, one of the resource barriers that I find that's most active right now is, you're right, she just went like this, right? Is knowledge, right? People feeling like, I don't have the knowledge to patronize this place. The second kind of barrier might actually be a physical barrier. Lots of people, especially now, you see lots of breweries going into revitalizing areas, and a lot of times there are kind of lines drawn in the sand across some cities and neighborhoods, and it's difficult to get people to move around physically, right? In a lot of ways, the opportunity there might be to move your product and not the people, right? So are your products, right, are your branding only seen in certain types of places? Is your beer only showing up at certain kind of events? The third type of barrier I want to talk about is cultural barriers. Again, cultural practices are deeply embedded, particularly around food and drink. And so you have to ask yourself, are the cultural practices in which my products are being served narrow? Right? Example, do your beer dinners, if you have beer dinners at your tap room, are they always the same kind of food at the same kind of and same price point? Right? Like, are you, like, on kale and pork belly, like, all the time? Right? And then lastly, you might have social barriers, right? Relationships between people. So example, would someone be embarrassed to drink out of your can in front of their mom? Right? And does that matter to you? Because if it does, that's an opportunity to address that barrier. I'll give you one personal barrier that I run into all the time, and to this day, it establishes where I go and where I don't go. excuse me. Ooh, that was bad. I've had the opportunity to travel a lot for some of my jobs, and I try to drink where I go, just to see what's local and what's great. And it's happened a lot, where I walk into a pub or a tap room or a brewery, and I get, can I help you? Right? And it's not like, can I get a beer? It's like, are you lost? Right? And for me, that's an immediate no. Right? Like, I might be like, you are nice and you are awesome, but if you are looking at me like I need to find my way to the whatever store, then I'm not coming back. Right? And that might be a completely unconscious gesture, right? I made an association and I acted on it before I really thought about it. But for me, that's it. That's a social barrier that I'm not crossing again because there's enough places to drink for me to choose. So the solution to all these barriers is to locate and remediate. Right? Find them and get rid of them. Right? Three things you want to think about when you're thinking about remediating your barriers. Right? Remember to stick to those established goals. Right? You had established objectives. Right? You can't take every barrier down all at the same time. Right? So if you have an established goal related to growth, remove barriers related to growth. Right? Do what you set out to do and try not to do everything. The idea of diversity can get really unwieldy once you get outside of what you define. Again, focus on the removal of your identified barriers rather than putting out bait to try to draw a population. And if you have a responsibility structure, lean on it. Right? That's what they're there for, and that's how they will help you. So in the interest of time, I will just give you 1 minute instead of a couple minutes. Right? Think about any potential barriers that you might have in your businesses and how you might go about trying to remove them. Right? So that person you just talked about with goals and other things, right, have a quick chat about this. Right? What are your barriers and how do you get rid of them? Go. Solid. All right, I'm sorry to cut you off. Just trying to move in the interest of time. Anybody really quickly have anything they want to share? Yeah, back here. Yeah?
We were talking about the diversity of our staff.
Yeah, can you run up to the mic? Yeah, that'd be great.
I hate the sound of my
own voice. I'm sorry.
We were talking about the diversity of the staff we have, which we're working on, but it's like, how do you do that?
Yeah.
And it was more about how you advertise your staff. So we, like, put it on Twitter, cool, but the people who follow our Twitter are maybe said demographic with a beard or whatever. It's like, where do you put your adverts out or do you understand what I mean? So
yeah.
It was just, that was our barrier, and maybe that was a potential fix.
Yeah, great.
Cool.
Awesome, thank you. In fact, one of the things we see in diversity literature over and over again that this is absolutely critical, right? Like opening up your pool so that like there's a chance for people to make the choice to come to you for a job. Whether that means open houses, going to talk to community colleges and high schools, right? Figuring out where people are so that you can kind of cast a broader net. All right, last problem, last metaphor. Is anybody in here responsible for recipe development at their brewery? Yeah. Would one of you mind, like, coming up and giving us, like, the quick, like, how do you settle on a new recipe? Like, the 30-second version. 60-second version. Yeah. What's the process like for you?
I'll give the best example that I can.
Yeah.
I'm military, hang out with a lot of guys in my unit, and they kind of just tell me what they like, what they want. And that actually gears more to my sergeant walks up and says, hey, man, I like brown ales. All right, cool. Go home, do a pecan brown ale, something like that. Kind of like looking around at what your community is. IPAs, like, for example, we're near Atlanta and Athens, Georgia. So they have these really big IPA beasts there, and you kind of get to see what the people are drinking. However, we have a German town that's just north of us, so then we can focus on, you know, all right, well, let's appeal to those people who want to come down south and maybe stop in at the brew pub. Let's make some German beers. So that's kind of, I don't know if that's, I'm exactly answering the question that you wanted. But
I'm going to follow up.
Okay.
So let's say you're talking brown ale. How many times do you have to make a brown ale before you settle on, like, okay, that's the one we're going to sell.
That's the one. Yeah. The one I have, actually, here's a better example. We named a beer after one of my buddies who got killed in combat, yeah. And we brewed that beer 20 times before 20. We said that is probably what we're going to stick with. So
yeah.
It just kind of depends on who, I guess, you're feeling, what you want behind it. I mean, beer is beer, but at the same time, like, it is yours. It's your baby. It's what, you know, what it means to you. So you have to figure out, I guess, what it means to you and what your purpose is. Why are you making an IPA? Well, because it sells, or because, you know, you like it and you want to make the best IPA that you can. Why did I make a Belgian wit? Because that's what my best friend drank, and thus it is brewed for him, you know, in his honor. So you got to really figure out what not only the clientele, but also, I guess, the driving force behind it. So, yeah, you're going to brew it multiple times. I mean, if you brew a beer once and say, that's it, that's the one, and then you brew it again and it doesn't turn out the same way, it's, you know, it's like a thesis. You got to make sure that you can repeat it multiple times. So yeah. I think...
Yeah.
I mean,
no, that's awesome. Thank you. And this beer that you brewed for your friend, you know, that you took through so many iterations, right? Like, when you were brewing, like, the 10th one, were you like, never mind, this is not going to work?
We, around 9 and 10, we're like, okay, we're getting close. And then at 15, I dumped the entire batch.
Yeah.
Because yeah. I was like, you know, I tweaked it, I guess, a little too much.
Yeah.
And, okay. You know, it's just, you gotta play with it.
Awesome.
So it's and it just stinks because you got to wait 2 weeks to figure out if it's where it's supposed to be or not.
Yeah,
so.
Thank you. Yeah, right? I mean, all of you who are involved in this process understand to, like, get to the product that you want, it can't be one and done, right? It can't be one and done. You can't sit down and, like, you know, scribble. This is the percent of my grist. These are my hop additions. Done, right? I'm putting it out to market. But unfortunately, this is what we think we can do with diversity and inclusion efforts all the time, right? Like, we think, like, oh, we'll do this thing. We'll do the training. We'll put it out there. It'll be awesome. Then they will come, right? But it's much more like developing a recipe, right? You got to try something and figure out and say, you know what? That didn't work. And you got to try something else and figure it out and be like, oh, that didn't work. And then you got to try something and be like, you know what? Let's think about why we're doing this. Let's remind ourselves of what's behind it, right? Whether it's your buddy, right? Or whether it's, like, my ethics, or it's this particular organizational outcome, right? And then you might have to try it again, and then you might be like, ugh, we got to scrap it all, and then we got to start it again, right? Diversity inclusion efforts are hard, and I will give you right now, even though I am totally not authorized to do this, I will give you permission to try and fail. Right? Because that's realistic. Right? You're not going to do one thing and then everybody's going to show up. And if you do one thing and everybody doesn't show up and you go, oh, it didn't work, never mind, right? Then you're never going to get there. Right? So forget the one and done. Diversity inclusion efforts that work are continuing, they are responsive, and most important, they include a means of assessment and evaluation. So if you remember those goals, right, we talked about measurable goals, right? This is why, because you want to be able to assess what's going on. I heard somewhere in the early of the week someone said, what gets measured, get managed, right? Same thing. What gets measured, gets managed. And this is where a responsibility structure is important, because that becomes someone's job, right, to evaluate and assess what's going on. If you can't easily assess your diversity goals and outcomes, think about revising them, right? Or better yet, think about a way that you can measure them in line with something you're already measuring, right? This is why I put sales out there, because everybody already measures this, right? If you can connect your diversity outcomes to something you're already keeping track of, right, you're saving yourself a little time and effort. Keep in mind that different diversity outcomes require different assessment strategies. So with your fans, right, you might have a hard time assessing this, right? Who exactly is drinking your beer? If you have a tap room, that's different. People are coming in. But honestly, optics aren't always the best text, right? But you might think about things like sales and distribution beta, right? Where is your beer going, right? Where restaurants are pouring it. Similarly, with your hands, right, this is generally easier to assess, but you need to make sure you're not assessing things in a way that are onerous for your employees. right? You don't want to be like, okay, we're going to do another survey, you guys, right? Like, get ready to check the boxes, right? As far as your brand, there's lots of things out there, particularly now with social media analytics, that allow you to assess, right, who's connecting to your brand and how. So as we head out, right, this would be the last assignment I give you. But again, I'm kind of a little bit crunched for time, so I'm not going to do it now. But what I want you to think of is, again, you formed some goals, you identified some barriers, you thought about some ways to remove the barriers, and the last piece is think about a way to assess how it's working for you, right? Whether it's working or not. Right? And the goal is to assess, and if it's not working, retool and re-put it in, right? And keep going 20 times, even if you have to throw out a batch number 15, and keep trying. So just to recap, right, we got our three metaphors, our three problems. Right? The black belt, right? Declaring you value diversity is not a means to an end, right? So you have to set goals, and they have to be actionable. Right? Ants, remember that just because you can't perceive a barrier doesn't mean it's not there. And that's how you need to focus your diversity inclusion area efforts, on removing perceived barriers. And that, just like a new recipe, diversity inclusion efforts have to be an iterative process. Right? You have to put things in, assess them, and then put them again, because inevitably the first try is not going to work. And I will leave you with a funny thought, not a funny ha-ha thought, a funny interesting thought. Right? The funny thing about diversity is that we generally see it as particular efforts to reach certain groups. But the very best diversity efforts, those that are most effective, improve the experience for everyone. And so as I close up today, I want to put out an invitation. As a diversity ambassador for the Brewers Association, one of my main charges is simply to listen to the membership, and get a sense of what you're struggling with, what you want to know. And I'm a social scientist, I'm a researcher, and so one of the things I'm really curious about is, what do you want to know? Right? What kind of information would be helpful for you to have as you think about expanding your diversity inclusion efforts in your businesses? So I'm going to give you the opportunity during Q&A. If you want to ask me a question, great. If you just want to tell me something you think I should know, let me know. I have 100 million business cards on me right now, so if you want to get my information and pop me something, that's great. Julia is down here, and she probably will help field some stuff if you want to get some information. But I just want to kind of send the message that, like, I'm here to hear what you are concerned with and what you're struggling with, and we can work together to kind of figure it out. We've all been kind of pounding the cliche drum this week, but, like, we're stronger together is really meaningful, right? It's a really meaningful way to organize, and that's absolutely how I feel about this particular effort. So it might not be fast, right? Might not be immediate, but we're committed. The BA is committed, and we absolutely want to see some visible change in the industry. So thank you all so much for your time. And I guess if you have a question, you can do the mics. Yeah, I think they want to have them on tape. Yeah, so it gets on the recording that way. Yes, ma'am.
First of all, just a huge thanks to you and to the Brewers Association for bringing this resource to our community. When you asked us what does success look like in those three categories, and when it comes to the hand side of things, for us, I think it would look like having an applicant pool that represents the diversity in the community, and what we're finding is we just don't get the people, you know, a diverse pool of applicants applying in the first place. And so, you know, one of those things I think is, you know, we can do our part to kind of, and we have a lot of work to do, I think each of us as a brewery and as an industry, but how can we help to kind of heal maybe some of the systemic barriers that we're partially responsible for historically?
Yeah, so this is a big one, right? If you can't get people to apply or you don't have an applicant pool to pull from, you're kind of stymied. So some of the things that work in a lot of other organizational settings, maybe not just breweries, Internships and specific types of mentoring relationships are often what we call pipeline strategies. So they may not necessarily give you a huge, broader net, but they're generally ways to kind of establish a line with a particular community. And you'd be surprised how quickly, like, when one person gets hit in the pipeline, they're like, hey, blah, blah, blah has a job, blah, blah, blah. Everybody's like, wait, that's an option, right? And it kind of will spread organically. So you might want to think about things that are more structured. I know some groups that do lots of, like, high school talks, so, like, career day type things. So you go into high schools in your community or particular places and say, like, here's what a brewer does, right? Like, here's our job. Because in a lot of places, people just don't think of that as a possibility, right? Like, as a possible job. And I'll tell you right now, like, STEM people love brewers. We have, so I'm the faculty advisor of a homebrewing club at my college. And twice a year, we go to a local brewery and talk about microbiology careers. And it's, like, the biggest event that we have. Like, you know, we might not be able to get everybody out for brew day, but they're like, career day at the brewery. Like, they flip out and they love it. And our breweries love it, right? You know, they know somebody who can talk about yeast science, like, from day one. They love that. So hopefully that gave you some ideas.
Okay. Yeah. Hi, I'm from Boston, which, if anyone didn't know, is a very white city. And I think one of the biggest problems that we have, honestly, in getting people of color and from different walks of life into the brewery is purely geographical, because Somerville is up here, and then the black population of Boston is all down here in this small little area that's, like, super inaccessible. Like, there isn't a train, there isn't a bus that goes there, there is, like, no real connection there. Mm-hmm. So, and then I guess the problem with moving into those communities is twofold, you know, so we want to, like, do events and things down there, but we, I guess my fear is that if we start doing events down there, who's coming? Are the people from the community coming, or are we just now helping to gentrify that area? Are we just bringing our people into a cheaper neighborhood, and they're just going to, like, oh, well, this is great, Aeronaut's here all the time, let's just hang out. Mm-hmm. How do you, I guess, do you have any tips on how to avoid something like that?
I don't know that I have specific tips about, like, right, slowing the train of gentrification.
Or not, it's not driving the train.
Right, basically. Right. That's a big one. But I would say a lot of times when you're talking about these kind of physical barriers or in cultural barriers, right, to be realistic, a lot of times connecting up with people who are already doing some similar work is a really good idea. Chances are every neighborhood already has some sort of grassroots group that's doing something that will connect up to, like, what events or ideas folks are thinking about. This is a totally random example, but I live in Central Virginia. We have this, like, Brew Ridge Trail thing. It's like a bunch of mountain breweries connected along there. And one of the breweries reached out to me. I was like, they're embedded in this county that's, like, older. Like, much older. I think the average age is, like, 60, right? And they were like, you know, lots of people come here. Like, we're kind of a destination brewery, but not a lot of people around our group come. Like, do you have some ideas of some things we can do? And I actually connected up with a friend who runs a church, and it's an Episcopalian church, and they decided that they wanted to brew some beer because their bishop was coming to visit. So we had, like, this slew of old ladies come and brew some homebrew in the, you know, on the brewery's facility, and, you know, the bishop apparently loved it. Right, but, like, people were, and now they come back. They actually have a beer and theology discussion group at the brewery now. I know. But, like, the idea is, like, that church group was already active. Like, they knit things for people who need things knitted. They make dinner on Thursdays for the community, right? Like, they're already churning. They're already this, you know, this piece of energy. And they just, somebody had to just kind of reach out and say, hey, like, can we make a useful connection?
Cool.
So I would suggest, like, making connections, yeah.
Once a week,
Thank you.
You started off by quoting, I think, another talk where it was white male, Gen X, millennial is the majority of drinkers. And I guess, I don't know, kind of statement more than a question is, what I worry about is the elitism that exists within the craft beer drinking community, both on the part of the patrons and on the part of the brewers. And everyone sort of embraces the beard and the tattoo and the man bun persona. And, you know, and when you're not in that club, well, actually, they don't want you in that club. You know, there's a coolness and a hip factor to that club that makes it special. So we're all agents of change. I know, and that's kind of why you're here and with the craft brewery thing. But I think that, you know, the patrons like their specialness as much or more than maybe us as a brewing community, and we have to deal with that.
Yeah, you know. But I always tell people, like, you know, do not get me wrong. I love a white guy with a beard. I mean, that's my people, right? You know, but I absolutely understand what you mean, right? Like, the I kind of call it, like, the politics of, like, scarce knowledge, right? That, like, I know a thing that you don't know, or I know this release is coming, or, right? Or, like, juice, right? Like, right, like, you know, like, that's there. But I don't think it's unworkable, right? I think it's a part of the thing, but I have a feeling, and maybe this is just my personal experience, but, like, I think people are really willing to open the door to that club, right? It may look uniform and seem exclusive, but I think a lot of people are actually like, okay, sit down, you know? And, you know, it's a little bit of an effort of just kind of pushing through that barrier.
It's our job to open that club. It's our job as brewers to open that club.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I have been a taproom manager for a couple of years. In the last couple of years, I have encountered situations of like, oh, I need to talk to a manager. I'm like, yeah, that's me. Like, oh, well, you don't look like it. Or someone will ask a question, and I'll start talking to them, and then I'll have a white male coworker come up to me. They immediately stop and go to that person and be like, oh, well, I figured you would know more. So, like, as a woman of color in this industry, I want to know, how do you personally deal with situations like that? Because I try not to let it get to me, because I know this is just, you know, it's the industry, but it's like, it's a little frustrating, like, what am I supposed to look like, or why does that person know more than, like, you know, than me, and I've been doing this for years now.
Oh, gosh.
I just heard that real quick on that. I'm a team of four founders. I'm the only female on the team. And literally, I stopped bringing the guys to meetings because they very much stay in their lanes and are very good at what they do. But I'm the CEO of the company, and I have the breadth of knowledge, especially on the build-out and the financing. And if I brought any of them to meetings with me, whoever I was talking to would not talk to me. They would talk to them.
Yeah.
And they're unconsciously responding because someone's looking at them and asking them a question. I'm like, that's not the proper way to frame that answer or something. And then it's awkward because I'm jumping in.
Yeah.
I mean, this isn't a great solution to you, but like, I just stopped bringing them with me.
And my coworkers, they see what's going on. So they're like, well, she's the manager. She's going to know. They're like, oh, I just figured, you know, you would know. I'm like, well, this is the lady you need to be talking to. And they're like, oh, you know, kind of like she took them back by it.
I think this is a situation where visibility really matters, right? Where it's, you know, again, I said earlier, like, optics aren't everything, but optics are something, right? It makes sense to kind of put leadership that doesn't stereotypically look like leadership in front and say, this is what our leadership looks like, right? This is what leaders can look like. And so I think, one, right, like, if you can be, and are you willing to be a more visible leadership figure, that helps, right? That goes a long way. Personally, I think it's work. It's like personal and emotional labor. But I think I have developed some strategies of like quickly whipping it out, right? Like here, right? Like here's my credentials, right? Like. Right, I can talk about Cohulam. Come on, like, boom, right? And so that people are just like, oh,
Yeah, okay, right. And that's, you know, hopefully a strategy that you don't need, right, going forward. But this is, you know, this is the reality, and this is what makes it hard, right? Like, this is why I start by saying, like, this is hard, because, like, this is real, and it's complex, and it's not going away in a day. Right? Thank you for sharing.
So I actually want to speak a little bit towards that as well, because this is my third CBC. So I've done Philadelphia, I've done D.C., and now in Nashville. And the year before Philadelphia, I was building my brewery with my business partner, who happens to be a male. And this is more of a statement to you as an ambassador for diversity and inclusion. One of the things that's been very disheartening for me personally in my business and also here for the Craft Brewers Conference is how we are treated by the ancillary supporters of the craft brewing community, mm-hmm. which is the vendors on the floor, which are the vendors that deliver grain to my door, and when they walk in to see five women and no men, make that assumption that obviously there's no one there to help them. What I've noticed over the last couple of years is when I will approach with my business partner that's a male or my actual life partner that's also a male that owns a separate brewery, it's almost like I'm wearing a cloak of invisibility. And it's really interesting because in these last couple of years, one, I am a co-owner of my business. I'm the director of operations and business development. I also am a teacher. I'm a professor of brewing sciences. And I serve on the board of directors of the Pennsylvania Brewers Association, or Brewers Guild. So it's like I feel like in these instances, one of the feedback points I want to make is maybe we also, as an industry, need to look at the vendor partners that we're working with. And if the vendor partners that we are working with do not have a diversity inclusion initiative or likeliness and how they treat our people when they come in, how they treat our patrons on our craft brewing floor, then maybe we need to have a different discussion with them because it's been actually pretty disheartening. I make a lot of big financial decisions that include a lot of money. And it's one of the most disappointing things every time I come to this conference. And the association or the assumption of as I walk up, the female representative needs to speak to me is even worse. So I feel like having these discussions, and I have them with my staff when this happens, because it does happen. We're 50-50 in gender divide from every position, which is not necessarily the norm, but I'm happy with that, you know. But us as owners and us as people of the industry, we have to look at who we support. And if the people that are coming in here that we're walking up to on the floor aren't treating us with respect, then maybe they shouldn't be here on the floor.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. I also wanted to let you know I wasn't, like, texting. I was taking notes.
Hi. So I have a unique title position at the brewery that I work at. I'm the experience manager, so I monitor customer experience and the coworker experience, making sure that's a good one. And one thing that I also do besides hiring, and obviously diversity was a big goal with mine when I started to hire. I really wanted to diversify our staff. Another big goal of mine, though, is to host charitable events that gauge or reach out to a specific community that we know is a big clientele of ours. But I think something that I constantly run into, because there's multiple people making these decisions on what we do and how we market ourselves, present ourselves, is the fear of alienating specific people. And a part of diversity is the white, cis, hetero, male who does feel villainized every time a person of color or LGBTQ member says something, oh, well, you know, heteronormative this or white man this. And how, I guess I'm just asking, how do you overcome the fear of alienating everyone, but also not alienating everyone, you know?
Yeah, can we real talk for a sec?
Yes, please.
You don't, right? I mean, we live in a world where, like, any decision you make it excoriated on Twitter, right? Mm-hmm. Within a few minutes, especially the beer Twitter.
Whew, yeah.
So I think, you know, again, this is part of the difficulty, part of the hard, because I think if people aren't willing to say that you are assuming a certain level of risk by making certain connections or certain decisions. If they, you know, if they're not willing to accept that, they're not being honest, right? There is a certain level of risk. But I think what you have to do is be really pragmatic about kind of cost-benefit ratios, right? What do I have to gain, and what does it mean to me, and what are the resources I have to invest in this? And does it align with my right corporate goals and my personal and professional and organizational ethics? And then make the risk, right? I think there was a lot of that yesterday, too, right? Like people saying, you got to show up. You got to be out there. You got to take a risk. And so, you know, maybe that's not the most satisfying answer in the world, but, you know, it's honest.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. So thank you. If I'm going to hang out up here or out there or somewhere I need to be. If you have more questions, I'd love to chat.